If a man willfully jumps off the roof of a 15-story building, well, God does not have to miraculously intervene to strike him down.
Right. Physical laws simply take over.
Exactly. Gravity just does the work, and the impact is inevitable. Now, what if that exact same inescapable physical law applies directly to our morality?
I mean, it is a profoundly sobering thought, but it is an absolutely essential one for us to grasp as believers.
It really is. And today we are taking a very deliberate, careful look at that exact concept. We are stepping away from the chaotic noise of modern culture to reflect on a deeply significant Sunday night message.
Yes, the message delivered on May 24, 2026 by Brother Steve at New Life Benson.
Right. The message is titled The Fall of the World, Judgment of the Nations. And our mission in this exploration is to examine these biblical warnings.
And really to distill exactly what we as Christians must remember as we navigate an increasingly dark and confusing world today.
Absolutely. But before we get into the heavy theological realities of the end times, well, I want to ground us where this message actually began.
That is a good idea.
Because it did not start in some ivory tower. It began in the everyday reality of a loving church family. I mean, Brother Steve opened his service simply thanking God for a recent rain, and praying for more.
Right, he acknowledged Memorial Day.
He did, and he
Yeah.
lifted up the very real, immediate needs of the congregation.
That context is just so important to remember. I mean, he was praying for Miss Joyce's friend Cynthia out in California.
Yes, who is battling a rare eye disease causing unexplained bleeding.
Right. And then, of course, we certainly cannot forget Kathy's urgent plea.
Oh, for the vacation Bible school cave workers.
Yes, which she wisely attempted to secure with the promise of an automatic supply of cookies.
A very solid biblical strategy, I might add.
I completely agree.
It truly is. But I love this contrast, it is a gentle reminder that profound, earth-shattering biblical truth happens right in the midst of our everyday church community.
He really does.
We are praying for rare eye diseases. We are organizing VBS, and then in the very next breath, we are contemplating the return of the King of Kings.
Which brings us perfectly to the foundational theology of Brother Steve's message.
Right.
The absolute certainty that, with God, there is no such thing as unfinished business.
No unfinished business. That phrase, well, it is the lens through which we must view the final judgment.
Exactly. It tells us that God will settle all accounts eventually.
But what is truly fascinating is how Scripture defines the one who will actually execute that judgment. Brother Steve drew our attention to a very specific, deliberate contrast in the Gospel of John, chapter 5.
Yes, this is such a remarkable distinction.
I mean, I have read John 5 a dozen times, and I completely missed the theological weight of this title shift until Brother Steve pointed it out.
It's easy to read right past it.
It is. In verse 25, Jesus is referred to as the Son of God in the direct context of resurrection. But just two verses later, in verse 27,
Even speaking of final judgment.
right, he is given the authority to judge specifically because he is the Son of Man. Why is there a sudden switch in his title in just two short verses?
I think many of us always assume those titles were somewhat interchangeable.
I certainly did.
But it is a brilliant distinction. It comes down to the actual mechanism of the action taking place. Think about resurrection for a moment.
Okay.
Resurrection is a profound miracle. It requires the active, miraculous, supernatural intervention of deity to raise a dead man to life.
Right, so he operates as the Son of God.
Exactly. But judgment requires no miracle at all.
Because judgment is just the natural consequence of the moral law.
Precisely. As Galatians 6 tells us, while a man simply reaps what he sows, God does not have to miraculously intervene to bring about the destruction of a sinful life.
That makes perfect sense.
The Lord, acting as the Son of Man, is merely pronouncing the final verdict that the man himself has brought to pass by his own willful sin.
By his rejection of Christ.
But
This is where that 15-story building analogy comes into play, and it is incredibly stark. Brother Steve likened the violation of God's moral law to that man stepping off the ledge.
right. Ezekiel 18:20 clearly states that the soul who sins shall die.
Jesus simply acts as the verdict pronouncer of a moral gravity that the sinner has willingly invoked upon himself.
It is the inevitable consequence of a life lived in rebellion. I mean, the wrath that comes upon sin is often just the natural result of violating the moral fabric of the universe that God created.
Moral gravity is just as real and just as unforgiving as physical gravity.
Absolutely.
You know, if we look at our modern secular society through the lens of that analogy, well, it paints a rather tragic picture.
It really does.
It is as if our culture has gleefully leaped out the window of that building, completely ignoring the law of gravity, and on the way down,
they're frantically trying to invent philosophical parachutes.
Exactly. They are in a complete free fall, but they think they can just redefine the laws of aerodynamics midair.
Right. By writing new legislation, creating new sociological theories, and entirely redefining human morality.
All while plunging toward the pavement. They are utterly refusing to acknowledge that moral gravity is absolute.
It is an extraordinary point. They are denying the very ground that is rushing up to meet them.
They really are.
They honestly believe their philosophies will somehow soften the impact. But no human reasoning can suspend the laws God has established.
So if moral gravity dictates that the rebellious world is currently in a spiritual freefall, well, what happens when they finally hit the ground? Because, you know, the ground is approaching rapidly.
That inevitable impact is the second coming of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And to understand what that looks like, we have to make a vital distinction between Christ's two coming appearances.
They are radically different in their nature and their purpose, aren't they?
Completely different. When Jesus comes back the first time, what we know is the rapture, described in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, he comes as a loving bridegroom.
Right. He is returning in the clouds to gather his bride, the church, taking us entirely out of the way of the wrath that is about to fall on the earth.
But the second time, which is described in Acts 1 and Matthew 25, when he returns physically to the earth at the end of the tribulation.
He is not coming in humility.
No. He is coming as a judge in flaming fire. And if you are listening to this right now on your commute or sitting in your living room, you might find this imagery deeply unsettling.
Modern culture has conditioned us to only accept a very specific, sanitized version of Jesus.
That is exactly right.
They want the gentle babe in the manger. They want the mild teacher sitting on a hillside. And he is those things.
Yes, he is.
But leaving out the returning warrior king is teaching an incomplete, fractured Bible. Brother Steve brought us to Jude verses 14 and 15.
Which references the very first prophecy regarding judgment given by Enoch.
Yes, and the language there is incredibly severe.
It truly is. In that single brief prophecy, Enoch repeats the word ungodly four distinct times.
Four times in one breath.
Right. He states that the Lord is coming to convict the ungodly of their ungodly deeds committed in an ungodly way, and for the harsh things ungodly sinners have spoken against him.
It is a complete, unyielding condemnation of rebellion.
It is.
That severity is echoed in Isaiah 63, which Brother Steve rightly called one of the most fearful passages in all of Scripture.
It is a staggering image.
It pictures God speaking in the third person, his garments dyed red, stained with the blood of his enemies as he treads the winepress of his fury completely alone.
And we see the culmination of that warrior king depicted with breathtaking detail in Revelation 19.
Yes, we do.
I want us to really slow down and visualize the imagery here because it is rich with historical and theological meaning. John writes that heaven opens for a second time.
And Jesus arrives riding a white horse.
Exactly. Now, to the first century reader, that specific detail would immediately trigger a very powerful image.
Right, because they were living under Roman occupation. They knew exactly what a white horse signified in that culture.
Precisely. When a Roman general returned victorious from a major conquest, he would ride a white horse down the Via Sacra.
The sacred street in Rome.
Yes. With his massive conquering entourage trailing behind him, it was the ultimate display of absolute, unrivaled authority and victory.
So John is telling us that Christ is returning not to negotiate, but to finalize his victory?
That is a perfect way to put it.
And his titles in that moment are so revealing. He is called Faithful and True.
Yes.
He is called Faithful because he always, without exception, keeps his promises. And he is called True because he always tells the truth.
But I think the detail that stands out the most is his weapon.
Yes, his robe is dipped in blood, but he isn't carrying a physical spear or a massive broadsword.
No, his weapon is the sharp sword coming from his mouth.
It is simply his spoken word.
Let us think about the profound mechanics of that for a moment.
Mm.
Why is his spoken word a weapon of such ultimate destruction?
Well, because it is the exact same mechanism of power that created the universe.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
In Genesis, God did not physically labor to build the stars. He spoke them into existence.
The breath of his mouth holds all matter together.
Therefore, it only takes the breath of his mouth to dismantle the rebellious nations. The word that creates is the exact same word that judges.
That is just an astounding truth. And, you know, if that level of absolute, unstoppable power is returning, it forces a very confusing question for me.
What is that?
If the ground is approaching and the impact is going to be this devastating, well, why do the nations continue to fight back?
This is a great question.
I mean, it is like trying to punch a hurricane. Why do they rage against something so overwhelmingly absolute?
For that answer, Brother Steve directed us to Psalm 2. And the psalmist asks that exact question.
Right. Why do the nations rage and the people plot a vain thing?
The kings of the earth set themselves.
Yeah.
And the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. They literally say, let us break their bonds in pieces and cast away their cords from us.
They view God's moral law as a set of restrictive chains. They honestly believe they are smarter, more enlightened, and more compassionate than the God who created them.
And what is God's response to this massive, unified, global rebellion?
Verse 4 says, he who sits in the heavens shall laugh.
Yes, but we must understand the nature of this laughter. It is not a laugh of amusement.
No, not at all.
It is not a chuckle at a joke. It is a laugh of pure derision. It is the laughter of a sovereign king witnessing utter, spectacular futility.
Because God has already made his move. The decree is already established, he says, yet I have set my king on my holy hill of Zion.
The rebellion is over before it even begins.
It really is. We see that exact same futility beautifully illustrated in Daniel chapter 2.
Oh, the statue here.
The Gentile world empires representing all of human achievement, government, and power are depicted as a great, terrifying, magnificent statue.
But a stone cut without human hands, which represents Jesus Christ, strikes the image on its fragile feet.
And the entire magnificent statue is just pulverized. It is crushed into dust. It becomes like chaff from the summer threshing floors.
Blown away by the wind without a single trace remaining.
The kingdoms of this world are utterly fragile when faced with the eternal stone.
The foolishness of man trying to fight back against this stone was perfectly captured in a story Brother Steve shared.
Oh, I remember this.
He mentioned his old dean of Bible studies, Gary Mitchell, who once showed him a Russian cartoon from the Soviet era.
I have to admit, when Brother Steve described this cartoon, I was genuinely shocked by the blatant arrogance of it.
It is hard to comprehend.
The image depicted a sprawling landscape of churches that had been blown up, just reduced to complete rubble, with thick smoke rising into the sky. And out of the ruins of these destroyed churches on earth, a massive ladder extended all the way up into the clouds.
Pointing toward a cross representing the Trinity.
Exactly. And on that ladder is a man climbing up into heaven holding a giant hammer.
Right. A man with a hammer.
And the caption beneath the cartoon read, having destroyed this God business here on earth, we are now going to destroy it in heaven.
It is truly incredible to consider the depth of that delusion.
It is a stunning level of pride. A man with a hammer climbing a ladder to overthrow the creator of the cosmos.
But if we pause and look around today, how often do we see modern governments, institutions, and cultures acting exactly like that man on the ladder?
All the time. They pass new laws, they alter educational curriculums to remove any trace of biblical morality. They mock absolute truth in the media.
They fully believe they can legislate or philosophize God out of existence.
They honestly think if they just strike the hammer hard enough, moral gravity will cease to exist.
But as Psalm 2 reminds us, God simply sits in the heavens and holds them in derision.
He allows them to attempt their foolishness for a season, but the reality remains entirely unchanged.
Right. He has already set his king on Zion. The stone is already cut.
Watching this rebellion unfold around us and knowing the absolute fierceness of the judgment that follows, it can feel incredibly heavy for a Christian walking through this culture right now.
It can be very discouraging.
If you are listening to this, you might feel a deep sense of anxiety about the state of the world. Where is our hope amidst all of this wrath and moral collapse?
That is precisely where Brother Steve provided a deeply comforting anchor at the end of this study. It is a foundational truth about the very character of the Lord.
And what a comforting truth it is.
It is simply not in God's nature to deliver a message of judgment without simultaneously providing a message of hope and grace. He never warns of the impact without offering a way of rescue.
We see that right at the end of Psalm 2. After outlining the rebellion and warning that the king will break the nations with a rod of iron, God graciously extends a warning to the rebellious kings.
He says, now therefore be wise, O kings. Be instructed, you judges of the earth.
And then he offers the ultimate invitation, kiss the Son.
He is pleading with them to reconcile, to show reverence and submit to the Son before the wrath is kindled. There is always an invitation to grace right up until the very final moment.
Even during the tribulation itself, which will be the darkest, most terrifying period in human history, God extends unprecedented grace.
He seals 144,000 Jewish evangelists, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. In the midst of unparalleled judgment, he sends out an army of witnesses who will lead a massive global revival.
Millions of Gentiles will be saved out of that terrible time. And when Christ returns at the Battle of Armageddon riding that white horse, well, not every living soul perishes.
Right. There are those who will be saved and enter the millennial kingdom. God's mercy is incredibly relentless.
I think the most poignant statement Brother Steve made, the one that really forces you to stop and reevaluate everything, is about where our surprise should truly lie.
Yes.
When we read Revelation 19 with the bloody robe and the sword, or Isaiah 63 with the treading of the winepress, we shouldn't be shocked.
The surprise is not that Jesus comes back as a judge. The surprise is that he ever came as a savior to sinful men in the first place.
What a remarkable truth.
Yeah.
We deserve the judgment. We are the ones who invoked the moral gravity by our sin.
The astonishing part of the gospel is not the warrior king on the white horse.
No, the astonishing part is the manger, the crown of thorns, and the cross. That the Creator would step into his own creation, taking on the likeness of sinful flesh, to save man from himself.
That is what should leave us entirely speechless.
Absolutely.
As we bring this reflection to a close, we really need to gather these heavy, beautiful truths and apply them directly to our walk this week.
Yes, we do.
As believers living in an increasingly dark, chaotic, and arrogant world, we do not need to fear the moral collapse around us.
We do not need to despair when we see the nation's rage or when we watch the culture climb a ladder with a hammer trying to dismantle truth.
We know exactly how the story ends. The true king is returning on a white horse, his word is final, and there is absolutely no unfinished business with God.
We can rest entirely in the sovereignty of God. The chaos we see on the news is temporary. His kingdom is eternal.
But resting in his sovereignty does not mean we remain idle or passive. And this brings us to a final, lingering thought for you to carry with you today.
If we truly understand the absolute certainty of moral gravity, if we know for a fact that the secular world is currently in free fall, desperately clinging to philosophical parachutes that will fail them upon impact.
And if we truly grasp the terrifying, glorious reality of the returning king,
how should that alter the urgency of your daily prayers?
How should that reality fuel the boldness with which you witness to your unsaved neighbors, your coworkers, and your family members this very week?
We know it awaits at the bottom of the fall. We hold the only true message of rescue.
Let that urgency drive you to your knees in prayer and open your mouth in bold witness. Stay firm in your faith. Keep your eyes on the skies and keep your focus solely on Christ as the things of this world fade away.
Until next time, grace and peace to you.